Hello and welcome to the Personnel Today Friday podcast. I'm Tara Craig and I'm joined by John Charlton and Noel O'Reilly. Coming up, we hear about the government's reaction to the Boorman Report's recommendations on the health of NHS staff. We hear from Royal Bank of Scotland's Greg Aitken on what the bank is doing to improve employee engagement. And we discuss a recent unfair dismissal case involving Redcar and Cleveland Borough Council. But first, the news. The Walker Review into Corporate Governance in the Banking Sector has recommended that banks be made to publicly disclose the number of their employees who earn more than £1 million per year. Insurance group AXA has urged the government to force employers to offer personal financial education programmes to their staff. AXA has also called for tax breaks and grants for companies that introduce workplace financial training. Two of the Tower of London's beefeaters have been dismissed after they were found to have harassed Moira Cameron, the first female beefeater. You can read these and other news stories in full on personneltoday.com. The Boorman Report into NHS Staff Health and Wellbeing was published last month, and this week the government accepted its recommendations in full. Noel, what are the implications for HR?
Well, there's major implications, I think, for HR in the NHS, because a lot of the emphasis in the Boorman Report is on managers' behaviour and embedding health and well-being of staff into all systems and structures. So, for example, NHS trusts will be assessed in annual performance assessments on health and well-being. Each trust will be expected to keep proper absence records and have proper management information on health and well-being, and they'll be expected to develop key performance indicators around health and well-being. And managers, as part of their performance appraisal, will have to show that they have done work to improve the health and well-being of staff, and they will be trained to do so. So major HR implications there.
Do we know how much this is going to cost to implement?
It shouldn't really cost very much at all. There will be some funding. There hasn't actually been a figure given. But the idea is that the savings in productivity will actually pay for it. So they're hoping to save about 3.4 million working days, equivalent to 14,900 extra staff in a year, and £555 million. So those savings will fund it. There won't be a major amount of funding for this.
What's the timetable for this now? Do we know?
Well, it's going to... The government actually has given it its backing like this week, and I think that already around the country, individual trusts have been talking about how they're going to implement it. So it's really something that's going to roll out over the next 2 or 3 years. It's not going to be something that transforms the NHS overnight. It's going to involve a whole-scale cultural change.
What might this mean for other employers?
Well, it should have an impact across the rest of the public sector, because within the NHS they're going to be producing guidelines, standards, good practice, which will be relevant to local government, central government and other parts of the public sector. It will help employers actually, in the sense that this new emphasis on early intervention when people become sick and getting them back to work will hopefully help other employers to get their staff to work, because they will be needing to really rethink and reconfigure NHS services away from acute care and towards trying to prevent people from becoming ill in the first place. And I think in general, in the private sector, there should be a knock-on effect, again, because of the guidelines and good practice and standards coming out of it. And it's notable that private sector companies are far less likely to provide occupational health services than public sector ones. So it may lead to an increase in demand for occupational health in the private sector.
Thank you, Noel. The Royal Bank of Scotland has scarcely been out of the news over the past year. Personnel Today's Kat Baker asked Greg Aitken, head of human capital strategy there, what the bank is doing to improve employee engagement.
Do you think your HR practitioners at the moment have the kind of the change management skills that are necessary to go through the changes that your bank and other banks are currently going through? Is that something that you've had to focus on, maybe increased training in that area?
We've been very lucky in the sense that we have always had quite a strong focus on change management. The HR function at RBS has always been involved in large organisational changes across the business. So whilst it's something that obviously there's a heightened focus in as we support our businesses through these changes, it's a skill and a competence to our itinerary that we already possess, and it's one that we're now having quite a lot of stretching challenges on and supporting our businesses as they get through them.
Okay. So when you say stretching challenges, what do you mean by that?
I think many of our businesses are changing their organisation at the same time, whether it be an EU remedy or whether it be the fact that the organisation's changing to adapt to the changing market conditions. So I know that a lot of this would be primarily around some of the impacts of the credit crisis, but some of it's about the impacts to ensuring that we're continuing to serve our customers. So
yeah,
you know, those are some of the main areas as well.
So are you offering them any more training or any more workshops on how to go about?
Yeah, so we do this as a standard in RBSN, anyway. So we had in the last couple of months we've had Dave Ulrich do some global audios on some topics, and also we've got David McLeod, who wrote the engagement study for the UK government, and he's partnering with our group HR director over the coming couple of weeks to do some global audios with our HR staff in partnership with myself and others to make sure that we're taking account of the changing, you know, organisational dynamics.
Pauline Scanlon was sacked from her post as Qualities Officer at Redcar and Cleveland Borough Council after complaining that an HR manager had been appointed without the job having been advertised. She's just won £400,000 at an employment tribunal. John, can you tell us a bit more?
Well, in fact, Mrs. Scanlon won £442,000, 466 pence in compensation, a huge amount, really. She was backed in the case by Unison, so she got legal representation by Thompson Solicitors, who are very much the favourites amongst unions for legal representation. Anyway, Scanlon was dismissed in August 2004 after, as you say, she complained that the council had breached its own equal opportunities policy by not advertising the post of HR manager. After she complained, she was suspended and was eventually dismissed in August 2004. After her win, she said she was delighted, unsurprisingly, and, quotes, relieved it was all over. But she said she'd lost 6 years of her life because I dared to challenge the unlawful actions of the then chief executive. Unison said she'd been victimised by the council's whistleblower, and Thompson said she was sacked on trumped-up charges brought about after she blew the whistle on her bosses. Unsurprisingly, Redcar and Cleveland Council said it was surprised at the level of the payout and it is taking legal advice about the issue, so we may well see a challenge to the decision and the amount of compensation. We contacted an employment lawyer to get some comment on this, and Bob Fahey at Matthew Arnold and Baldwin came back and said that the size of the award was striking, but is a clear illustration of the potential financial consequences where a dismissal is tainted by whistleblowing or discrimination, and the statutory cap of £66,200 for unfair dismissal compensation does not therefore apply. It seems that Scanlon was pretty upset by the fact that the position was not advertised. As the tribunal mentioned, her intemperate language and zealotry in pursuing the issue and other equal opportunities issue. But the tribunal did say, if policies designed to ensure equality are being set aside on the basis of management expediency, then what was the purpose of her job? Fahey also said, and this is a lesson for HR management, that if an employee reports in good faith that they believe their employee had been involved in one of the protected categories of malpractice under the Public Interest Disclosure Act of 1998, in this case a breach of its legal obligation, any dismissal that is by reason of the protected disclosure is automatically unfair, and it is unlawful to subject the employee concerned to any other detrimental treatment short of dismissal by reason of that disclosure. Employees will not lose protection simply because they are intemperate or tactless in the way they make their disclosure.
Were there any other messages to come out of this?
Yeah, well, I thought Fahey made a good point in telling us that an employee who makes an allegation in good faith of discrimination, whistleblowing and so on other protected grounds is protected from less favourable treatment as the result of having made that allegation. And Fahey said it's not necessary, which I find quite interesting, for the allegation to be true only that it was made in good faith. So I think HR staff, HR managers faced with these kind of issues should bear that in mind, because they may well think, well, this allegation is a load of rubbish, if you will, is not grounded in fact. But if the allegation is made in good faith, then it has to be taken seriously. And this can be a difficult issue for HR advisors to deal with, especially if they are advising managers, which may have been the case in this case, who just want to get on with a course of action that they have decided upon.
John, what would you say was the key message in a nutshell for HR then?
Well, first of all, I think they have to follow their own equal opportunities policies. That's an absolute standout from this case. And also, they have to be strong when dealing with line managers or when advising line managers, and say really they have to stick by their own policies on various issues. And obviously in this case, we're talking about equal opportunities, because it could cost them dearly.
Would you say that also the level of risk is going to be greater if there's a potential whistleblowing dimension to it as well?
Well, obviously, this case will not have gone unnoticed, especially in trade union quarters. As I mentioned, Thompson's handle a lot of trade union claims, so trade unions will draw some comfort from this, and because precedence is so very, very important in English law, and we'll see this as setting some sort of benchmark, I would think.
Thank you, John. Well, that's it from this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. Remember to go online to check the latest news and views from the HR community at hrspace.co.uk. That's hrspace.co.uk. Until next week, goodbye.